From the Sky News Centre at 5, tests are being carried out on animals from a third farm to see if it's the source of an E. coli outbreak. White Post Farm in Nottinghamshire voluntarily closed when four people in the East Midlands caught the bug. Two other sites in Surrey had to shut after a spate of cases there. Professor Jonathan Van Tam from the Health Protection Agency says the latest closure is a precaution.
Two of the patients have very, very good histories that would give us reason at least to suspect that there are other routes by which they might have acquired the infection away from the farm. So it's a complex picture.
A jury's been hearing that a man accused of trying to flood Jersey with hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of cannabis was also wealthy. He was in the Sunday Times rich list. Curtis Warren reportedly used contacts in Holland to arrange for the drugs to be smuggled through France and onto Jersey. Warren from Liverpool, along with five other men, denies the charges. The search for missing chef Claudia Lawrence has taken an international twist. North Yorkshire police have sent officers to Cyprus, where the 35-year-old frequently visited. Detectives say she's befriended a number of men there who they want to talk to. Her sister Ali is still clinging to the hope she's alive.
We're hoping that someone who's maybe seen some strange behaviour or has noticed something, that the public will still come forward and help us to find Claudia.
Police have confirmed a 32-year-old woman and a girl of four died in a fire last night in Swansea. Three other children, aged 9, 12 and 15, are being treated for their injuries in hospital. Thousands of motorists caught driving in bus lanes in Manchester have been let off. The city council is having to refund 18,000 people because the cameras which caught them hadn't been officially approved. And British lottery history could be made today if a single UK ticket holder scoops the Euro Millions jackpot. The estimated £85 million prize would be the biggest yet paid out to a winner here. That's the latest. I'm Dave Terris.
Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
You think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
FM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio with me to review this week's news is Liberal Democrat MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Also with me is our regular old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers, who will be doing his best to cut through the economics jargon for us. Activists and anarchists from all over Britain have squatted Bristol's empty pro-cathedral between the Clifton Triangle and Brandon Hill to discuss and act on the financial crisis, climate change and Britain's unpopular military adventures abroad. We ask whether the anarchists have a point. Is our democratic party political system failing us? But before our celebrity and sport-free discussion, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend averaging 19 degrees Celsius in the daytime and dry with sunny spells. Next week round about 18, 17 degrees Celsius, some sunny spells and some rain. Next weekend, that's the 26th and 27th of September, it'll be quite a lot cooler, 15 degrees Celsius average, fairly cloudy with a few sunny spells on Saturday and gusty winds, rain next Sunday, that's the 27th of September. And the week after next, averaging down to 13 degrees Celsius, so it's getting quite considerably cooler. That was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. So, on to our look through the week's news, and with us in the studio this week is Stephen Williams, who's the Liberal Democrat MP for Bristol West. Welcome to Drive Time, Stephen.
Thanks very much.
Now, you nabbed the Bristol West constituency from Labour at the last election. How did you manage that?
By sheer hard work and persistence over a long period of time, I'd say, is the starting point. But also, I think by 2005, people had become a bit cheesed off with the Blair government at the time, particularly over the Iraq War, and I think that was the single biggest political issue that played into our hands.
So how about you yourself? Are you from Bristol?
I've lived here all my adult life, like an awful lot of people in my constituency. I came to study at Bristol University and I stayed, and every time I go out door knocking I meet people who did just that. But I grew up in South Wales.
Okay, what did you do before you became an MP?
My degree at Bristol was in history, but and that is still one of my main sort of interests in terms of reading for pleasure. But I qualified as a tax and business consultant with the world's largest consulting firm, which is now called PricewaterhouseCoopers. So I gave tax advice to small and medium-sized enterprises, and I'm afraid some rich people as well, which my co-panelists may not approve of.
So were you? So what were you doing, trying to help them avoid paying tax?
well, tax avoidance and tax evasion is some of the things that people get mixed up about. Tax avoidance is really tax planning. You know, opening an ISA account is tax avoidance on that basis at its simplest level. Tax evasion is telling porkies, and that's illegal, and certainly no professional person would go anywhere near that. You're just enabling people to run their business in an efficient way, and quite often, to be honest, your intervention made sure that people paid the right amount of tax. When left to their own devices, they may have underpaid.
Okay, and we're also joined by Martin Summers, our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, can you tell us in a nutshell why you believe the Treasury have made the wrong decision for the British people in bailing out the banks?
Well, I don't think they've made the wrong decision. That's something had to be done when the banking systems collapsed. But as Vince Cable has pointed out for the Liberal Democrats, chucking money at them without getting anything in return is not really what should have happened. It's not so much the propping up of the banking system that I disapprove of. It's what subsequently happened. This was an opportunity to restructure the whole thing in a more people-friendly direction, and that opportunity has not been taken either here or in the United States, and that's very worrying because you only get one real crack at that.
Okay, now let's take a look at some of this week's stories, and we start with something which was in The Guardian by Seamus Mill earlier this week. The cuts agenda is a brilliant diversion from the real crisis, says Seamus, who was famously the comments editor. I'm not sure if he still is the comments editor at The Guardian. He's saying that instead of an argument about how to beat the slump, what's happening is triggered by the banking crash. All three main political parties, apparently, are now competing over how to cut public spending and services. Martin, do you want to start on this one? Do you think Seamus has got a point here, that he's saying that the Tory party have actually been very clever in moving the agenda over to just simply a debate about where the cuts are going to happen and when?
Well, it's not just the Tory party, as you've pointed out. I mean, Gordon Brown at the TUC this week is singing from the same hymn sheet. Perhaps Stephen will clarify the Liberal position on this in a moment. What Seamus is pointing out is there's a cultural belief in that you must balance budgets, and these kind of cultural beliefs are very deep-rooted. They go back hundreds of years, and of course it's very difficult to explain to people that national economies don't function like personal households, and that in actual fact this would be disastrous. You're probably going to have to keep a slack fiscal policy, that's to say large government spending, going forward into the next year and the year after, in order to prevent the economy from crashing. Attempts to cut public expenditure too early in the cycle, as happened in the 30s, will probably, and in Japan in the 90s, will plunge the economy into a worse mess than it's already in. That's not to say that spending solves the problem. All it does is it stops you collapsing. But I think it's very difficult to get that through to a public that's been bombarded for 30 years with the ideology of balanced budgets, free markets and all the rest of it. It's got a hangover, a half-life that we can't quite shake off.
Well, I think Martin is right that cutting public expenditure early on in the next Parliament would be a mistake, and that's exactly what my colleague Vince Cable has been saying. It's certainly not our agenda, the Liberal Democrat agenda, to have cuts in frontline public services straight after the next general election if we're in a position to influence the government of that time. What we have been saying, though, is that given that we have piled up unprecedented amounts of government debt. I mean, Martin's absolutely right. Governments over time always run deficits, and it's the numbers can seem extraordinary to ordinary households. But the sheer size of the accumulated debt we're accumulating at the moment, running into hundreds of billions, makes previous sort of deficits in the 80s and 90s recessions pale into insignificance. We really do have to tackle them. So we are suggesting some long-term cuts in government programs, and the most obvious big sort of phallic symbol on the defence front would be the Trident missile program, which we think doesn't need to be replaced, and that would save billions.
Do you think that the Liberals have got a really different approach then? I mean, I know Vince Cable many people have noticed that Vince Cable has been quite saying things differently to many of the other political parties. So do you think that the Liberals have staked out their territory as very different from the Conservatives and Labour on how they're going to deal with this?
Well, I think Vince and the Liberal Democrats generally are speaking from the position where we've got this analysis right so far. Doesn't mean we're going to get everything right in the future, but we certainly called a credit crunch crisis correctly. We called what to do about the collapsing banks correctly, most particularly Northern Rock, should be nationalised. I can remember in my first few years as an MP in the House of Commons sitting on our benches when Vince was speaking about the credit bubble that was going to burst and it was all unsustainable, being jeered by Tory and Labour MPs, who would shout, you know, in a sort of mock voices, "Ooh, we're all doomed," across the chamber at Vince. Of course, no one laughs at him anymore, because he was proved to be right. And I think if only Gordon Brown had listened, not just to Vince Cable, but to all the other warnings that he'd received in the run-up to the crash a year ago, we wouldn't now be in the situation that we're in.
So do you think that it is necessary to have cuts? Because many people are thinking, well, hang on a minute, why should we be suffering from less and less public services because of the failures of these private banks?
Well, it's a question of where government expenditure is trimmed. I think it is right that government expenditure is going to have to be trimmed, but there are many either wasteful things that the government does or things we just simply disagree with. I've mentioned one already, the renewal of the Trident nuclear missile program, which is something we disagree with. That would save billions of pounds. There are other sort of prestige flagship defence projects that we probably don't need to go into anymore because circumstances have changed, such as the next stage of the Eurofighter. There are other intrusions into civil liberties, like not just the ID card, but the whole database that goes with it, which we've opposed anyway on civil liberties grounds, but stopping that in its tracks now would save billions in the long run too. So we are suggesting some concrete examples of where government money could be saved, taxpayers' money could be saved, but it wouldn't affect the services we receive in our doctor's surgery or in the classroom or when we catch public transport.
What about you, Martin? Do you think that it's necessary that it is possible to trim a lot from the government expenditure without really affecting people on the ground?
Well, the bottom line is you don't want British government treasury bonds to lose their AAA rating. Although, of course, the rating agencies have shown themselves to be completely complicit in this bubble and the crisis. That, you know, they need reform as well. So there is a limit to how much you can run a deficit. I agree with Steve about that. I also agree that the kind of cuts he's suggesting are perfectly okay with me. Whether they'd be okay with the existing government, I don't know. Probably not.
But I mean, in previous weeks, you've been arguing for actually increased expenditure on public works programs and house building and this sort of thing.
That's what you need to do. That's what you need to do. But you've got to get the resources from somewhere. You can expand the public deficit. We might have to look at reform of the monetary system tout court. Yeah, it's quite possible if we have another crash, which may happen before Christmas or early in the new year, we'll have to reform not just the financial system, but the monetary system.
But I mean, this is fantasy, isn't it? Britain can't reform its financial system separately to other parts of the world.
The ball really is in the court of the government of the United States of America. But of course, Britain follows the United States of America and influences the United States of America. So we've got to keep our eyes focused there. We shouldn't masochistically cut things which we need, because that's what will hold the economy up. If we need new houses, we need all of the services that Stephen was suggesting, you know, health services and education services and so on. And you should invest for the future in a recession. That's the way you beat it. But you can only do that if you've got the resources. Now, that means you either have to borrow or make up the money, which is the other thing I was just suggesting.
This quantitative easing, well, not printing money, or not?
What they're printing money and giving it to the banks. It's feasible for the government to actually control entirely the money creation system. In the American Civil War, for example, Lincoln, instead of borrowing money from the banks, printed greenbacks, which were government money, and spent them directly into the economy. Now, we're not at that stage yet. Nobody in the mainstream is suggesting it.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but hasn't this quantitative easing, isn't that essentially the same?
What quantitative easing is actually that money actually goes through the existing banking system, which is the problem. You may want to get rid of the existing banking system and the government spend the money directly into the economy. Now, this is all a bit abstract at this stage. Yeah,
I don't think it's too abstract. Should the government be putting this money directly into the economy, or should it be going via the banks, Stephen?
I would imagine a lot of people driving their cars or listening while having their tea at home are scratching their heads at the intricacies of this discussion. And I think to some extent it's something we may need to worry about hypothetically in the future. In terms of what the government has done with a large dollop of money, though, one thing where I disagree with them is the £12 billion, roughly, that the VAT cut is costing us. Now, I was speaking to an audience of Bristol businessmen last week, and I asked them to put up your hands if you think the VAT cut has been of any help to your business. And not a single person, there was 150 people in the room, so it wasn't a small audience, put their hands up. But that's cost billions that could have been used locally, for instance, to reopen the railway line to Portishead, could have done the first stage of the electrification of the railway line out of Paddington to Temple Meads. It could have put more money into social housing, into council housing, which the government, after 12 years now, seems to be waking up to having some interest in. There are many ways that money could have been spent productively, particularly in the construction sector, where people have been losing their jobs, architects are leaving university with no practice to go to. That money could have been much better spent rather than frittering it away on a few pence off DVDs and CDs and other things on which VAT is charged.
But I don't think it's fair to say that people can't understand the difference between giving the money to the banks to then lend to us rather than actually spending that money directly into the economy. Because I think a lot of people are feeling that maybe the idea of propping up the banks is not the best one, that maybe we should be thinking about some greater reforms.
I was giving specific examples of direct government expenditure, such as railway investments or council house spending, any other sort of infrastructure investment that the government procures from the construction industry and does, if you like, then directly put the money in the hands of businesses and individuals, rather than, as you say, giving it to the banks in the hope that they will renew their lending to British businesses. I mean, we're in this crisis because the banks were reckless in their lending. We now have an unfortunate situation where many businesses in Bristol tell me that their banks are now being far over cautious to them as good British businesses with an impeccable credit rating and track record, simply because of their reckless lending abroad in the past.
Okay, Martin, any more to say on this one?
I think the banks are much more insolvent than they appear to be, and we shouldn't rule out the possibility of a further crash. And I'm not saying that I'm wishing this, I'm just saying that we need to keep our minds open for the possibility of this, and then we'll have to take even more radical measures. But the measures taken so far are not sufficiently radical in the way that Stephen has suggested. The government hasn't really grasped the nettle in many respects here. They have cutting VAT, as you quite rightly point out, did virtually nothing but just actually undermined the public finances.
And it's still frittering away money every month until Christmas.
I mean, the danger is that cuts in public expenditure, and I think this is the final point I'd like to make, is that you actually end up with less government resources because the economy goes down, so that you get less in tax receipts, so that in actual fact you cut yourself into a worse corner than you're already in. And that's not to say you can get out just by spending, because you can't.
Finally then, Stephen, should we be propping up the banking system? Should we be changing the way it's regulated, or should we wipe the slates clean and start from scratch with a new banking system?
I don't think we can wipe the slates clean and have a new banking system go right back to 1694, whenever it was the Bank of England and state banking, if you like, first started. But certainly there needs to be much tougher regulation of the activities of senior executives and directors in the bank. One thing that's been suggested recently by Nick Clegg and Vince Cable, I'm sure will be met with howls of anguish by the bankers, is that directors should not get a bonus Yes, they should get a good salary and maybe some perks, but they shouldn't have a bonus because it seems to be the bonus culture that has driven them into taking reckless lending decisions. So if the senior management can't get a bonus, then that culture of reckless lending will hopefully be frittered out lower down the banking scale as well.
Okay, on to our next story then. And this was in the Daily Mail last weekend. This is, has Osama bin Laden been dead for 7 years? And are the US and Britain covering it up to continue the war on terror? Well, this this was by Sue Reed in the Daily Mail. And also, I was just kind of wondering about this one because we even had another message from Osama bin Laden this week, supposedly, which came out on... not all of the news papers dealt with it. In fact, The Guardian said alleged bin Laden, alleged bin Laden tape found or transmitted. But anyway, Martin, can you start on this one? I mean, this whole business, is bin Laden a bogeyman that's put there for us to be afraid of, or is he really kind of still doing his operations from Tora Bora or Saudi Arabia or wherever?
Well, the simple answer is that the ordinary punter like us sitting here doesn't know. We're told various things by various people, and we have to make our minds up who we're going to believe, because there's a huge, huge maelstrom of information and disinformation circulating about these topics. I think what more interesting is what was reported in 2001 by the French Secret Service to Le Figaro, and that was carried on Newsnight and on Channel 4 News here, that the CIA had met with bin Laden in the American hospital in Dubai on July the 4th, 2001. Because he was having a kidney operation, and they popped him with some get-well pads and some grapes. That's according to the French Secret Service briefing off the record.
Well, I suppose the question is, was the kid successful?
Well, the rumours I've heard is that he is dead, but then they are only rumours, and nobody can really say what's right or wrong about a rumour, can
they? Well, he certainly, just before the September 11th attacks in 2001, he certainly was a very sick man just beforehand, and I've seen some more credible reports from two doctors in the United States who say they've analysed one of the earliest of the videos, and it looks like half of his one side of his body is paralysed. As he's speaking, there's one side of his body that doesn't move at all. But this is all rather speculative. What are your thoughts, Stephen? I mean, why is it that we don't know whether Osama bin Laden is alive or dead?
I think we can safely say that if the US forces had killed him, they would have been crowing about it by now, and we'd know that for certain. But in the absence of any other information, as Martin says, we really don't know. I think we should also caveat this by saying don't believe everything you read in the Daily Mail. I would say that in general, not just this particular story. But if I can sort of widen it a bit, if you'll allow me, into our mission in Afghanistan. Because, I mean, this is where bin Laden was originally holed up in September 2001 and supposedly was bombed out of his hideaway. But we've now had British and American forces in Afghanistan for 8 years. It is 8 years, roughly this week, isn't it, since 9/11. And that's the longest military engagement British forces have had for over a century. And I think we really do have to start asking some searching questions about what our mission is there in Afghanistan. It was fairly clear at the start. It was to bump off bin Laden, close down al-Qaeda and frustrate their training of terrorists to come and threaten our liberties here in Europe or North America. And maybe it was successful in that in the early stages. But since then, the mission has supposedly been democracy and human rights. Well, the recent elections in Afghanistan, I think, have proven that to be a bit of a joke. Maybe suppressing the poppy harvest, because most of our heroin comes from Afghanistan as well. Is it about women's rights and freedom of expression? Is it about educating a largely illiterate population? Is it about imposing a nation state on a country that's never really had that sort of structure? Our mission there seems to be a complete week after week now in the House of Commons, I've heard first of all Tony Blair and then Gordon Brown start PMQs by saying, and I have to inform the House of the sad death of a British serving soldier. And I don't want to go on hearing that throughout the next term of the next Parliament. And I think we do have to start asking, why are we there? What can we hope to achieve? And what is the end game?
Do you think it matters, Martin, whether bin Laden is alive or dead?
I think, can I answer in two ways? First of all, just to comment about what Steve said about Afghanistan, much of which I agree with, although I think he's What the outside world sees of our motivation here is control of Caspian oil, threats to China and Russia. This is the geopolitics of intervening in Afghanistan. That's why the Russians go to Afghanistan. That's why we've gone to Afghanistan. It's not all about our good intentions. That's not how people in the third world look at our behaviour or look at the way we act. So that's the first thing I'd say about that. The perception on the ground in Afghanistan and elsewhere in Pakistan is that we are not there for the good of the locals. We are there for our own nefarious purposes. And just to remind people that it's absolutely on the record, documentary history, that Osama bin Laden was a CIA asset in the 1980s when we were supporting the Mujahideen, Gulbuddin Hekbatchir, to fight the Russians. Now, at what point bin Laden stopped being a CIA asset is a very important question. He was a CIA asset, and now he's not, and he now may be dead. But what I'd like to hear is somebody from British intelligence or from the CIA say, at what point did bin Laden go rogue, because we know for a fact that he was working with you. Was he working with you in November 2001, as the French Secret Service alleged? That's what we need. In July 2001, sorry?
What do you mean?
As the French Secret Service
from his hospital bed?
Well, I mean, the point about this is we don't know what's going on here. And what I would say to people listening to this programme is you don't have to believe anything about any of this, because there's lots and lots of disinformation. We need to keep a sense of the overall purposes of what we're trying to achieve in Afghanistan, and I think that we are getting into a dreadful muddle. And I think the problem is that there are forces at work driving policy, particularly in the United States, which are not to do with what's good for Afghanistan or even what's good for the ordinary people of the United States. We're talking about oil companies, arms industries, and so on. And these are very big, powerful vested interests.
So, Stephen, would the Liberal Party withdraw British forces from Afghanistan?
We've not made that statement just yet, but Nick Clegg, I think, bravely has sort of broken cover on this issue and is now raising questions that I was just mentioning about what our mission is there, because it's a very long mission and we're not clear what the outcome's going to be, and British servicemen's lives are being lost, but also every single week, you know, people are being horribly maimed and being mentally scarred as well, and we shouldn't forget the anguish that service families have to face.
Just to round up on this story, the reason that this was in the Daily Mail last weekend, this piece about bin Laden, was that there's a new book out called Osama bin Laden, Dead or Alive, by Professor David Ray Griffin. He's a US emeritus professor at California's Claremont School of Theology. And apparently the book is causing shockwaves around the United States. The book claims that bin Laden died of kidney failure or a linked complaint on December the 13th, 2001, whilst living in Afghanistan's Torabora Mountains, close to the border with Waziristan. Okay, on to our next story, and there are to be no charges, we hear today, for the police marksman who shot a barrister in central London last year. The chap's name is Mark Saunders. Now, my reason really for bringing this up is because we do seem to see that there may, I mean, certainly the family and the wife of this chap who was shot, Mr. Saunders, is saying from the day Mark died, Elizabeth has been committed to ensuring the circumstances of his death should be subject to the most rigorous and detailed examination. And she's been highly critical of the police, and the man's family has questioned why it was necessary for police to shoot him dead. Apparently he'd stopped shooting this shotgun at the time he was shot, and I wonder if you think that the police have overreacted here, and whether you, either of you or both of you, agree with this decision to just allow these policemen off for shooting this chap. Well, it seems they may have been able to deal with it in a, for example, he was shot in the heart, where maybe he could have been brought down and not killed.
But I must admit, this is not a story I've followed with great detail. I'm rather more familiar, as probably most people are, with the shooting on the tube train of Juan Charles de Menendez in the aftermath of the July 2005 bombings, and that was... there are an awful lot of questions that still need to be asked about that, I think, and I don't know whether this falls into the same category or not, but it does appear to have been a decision by the Crown Prosecution Service not to pursue charges. It's not just the police internally deciding there were no further questions to ask. The CPS is supposedly, well, is independent of the police, and they've come to that conclusion. So in the absence of any more detailed knowledge, I think it's very difficult for me to question that.
What about the principle, though? If someone is, you know, is behaving dangerously, should the police be attempting to either to bring them down, to disable them, or is it okay, do you think, for the police to be immediately starting to think about using lethal force?
I personally would be very worried if we'd got to a point where police shoot to kill in this country. I don't want to see the day where police are routinely armed. We do know that arms are now routinely available to the police, which is a different thing. And if they are shooting to kill rather than shooting to wound, and under what circumstances they should shoot at all, I think we do need to have a full public debate about whether we want our police to have these powers.
Martin, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think, as Stephen says, the shooting of John Charles de Menezes is a much more serious incident because it's the police were caught lying there. They were saying that CCTV footage in Stockwell Station wasn't working when, of course, everybody knew that the CCTV footage had been vamped up as a result of the bombings the previous week.
Well, in this particular story, it's been one of the things that's been criticised is the fact that the police officers involved in this shooting actually colluded afterwards, and so that they had statements.
This is in this shooting of the barrister.
Yes, that's right. So that apparently now the Metropolitan Police and other police forces have been issued with guidance saying that the police officers involved in cases like this are not allowed to speak to each other immediately afterwards when they're writing up the incident in their notebooks.
Okay, well,
so one thing that's come out of this.
I'm loath to comment on this particular case, which is obviously a tragic case for all involved, because it's very easy for us to sit here and pontificate. I would make the point, though, that if firearms teams of the police are trained to shoot to kill, because that is their training. If somebody has been shooting, if you've made the decision that somebody is dangerous enough to shoot at, you don't shoot to disable, you shoot to kill, and that is their training.
But his wife.
The question is, should they have crossed that line?
What his wife is arguing is that they should have shooted disabled him because he'd actually stopped shooting at this point.
If somebody has already opened fire with a lethal weapon, you could say that the safety of your own people requires you to shoot to kill. I think the idea of shooting to disable is a red herring. You either shoot to kill or you don't shoot at all. That's the issue. I mean, they shouldn't have shot John Charles de Menezes, for example. He'd showed no evidence of being a danger to anybody. And of course they claimed afterwards that he was a suicide bomber. They also claimed that he jumped over the barriers at Stockwell and all sorts of things, which turned out to be untrue. And that's the problem, is when the decision to shoot has been taken in the wrong way. But I can't, this particular case, it's very difficult to comment unless you've got knowledge of the actual circumstances.
Stephen, do you think there's a case here, as Mark Saunders' wife is saying, the police should be trained to disable people rather than to kill them?
Well, I must admit, I wasn't aware of what Martin's just been saying, that the police are only taught how to shoot to kill. I would have thought it should depend entirely on the circumstances. Now, if John Charles Mendes had been a suicide bomber, then shooting to kill was the appropriate response. But where someone is perhaps with a firearm in a street and has been disabled in some other way, or is no longer a threat to passers-by because the street's being cleared, is the response then to shoot to kill, or is it to shoot them in the kneecaps or whatever to disable them? I don't know enough about the police's internal guidance or training to know what circumstances match the response, but I would be disturbed if the only response when shooting is to kill rather than to bring someone down and stop them being a danger to others.
Well, this shooting of Mark Saunders in central London last year, we've not heard quite the end of this yet because we've still got an inquest and I imagine we'll be hearing the results of that in a few months' time. Next story is I was tortured. Apparently, the Iraqi journalist who was jailed for hurling shoes at George W. Bush was tortured, as he's saying, when he was freed last week, when he was in jail. Rather than being repentant, the outspoken TV journalist immediately launched a fresh tirade against the United States. He claimed Iraqi police had subjected him to beatings, whippings and electric shocks during his first few days in custody, and that he still feared for his life. Martin, what about this one? I mean, this does seem that this is only going to inflame opinion in Iraq.
Well, opinion in Iraq is already inflamed, let's face it. There's been a horrible war going on there for some time. The regime that we now have in Iraq, we really do have to ask ourselves whether the blood and the treasure we have expended to put them in power has really been in the interests of the British people or the Iraqi people. The torture seems to be endemic, violence is endemic. I hope that the Iraqi people can resolve their political differences because they deserve a better future than they seem to be getting. But it does seem that angels rush in where fools fear to tread. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread, sorry. We seem to have got ourselves an ongoing mess in Iraq, and this is just a part of it.
Another thing to add is that there was another piece in the news yesterday which was saying that an American patrol has shot and killed somebody just a few days ago who'd thrown a shoe at an American patrol. Stephen, what are your thoughts on this one? Because one does feel that the battle for hearts and minds in Iraq is absolutely irrevocably lost, and this is just another nail in the coffin.
Yes, well, of course, the Iraqi police officers have been trained by American and British soldiers and other operatives, and they are now operating the jails, which presumably they have taken over from American and British servicemen. And, of course, unfortunately, we didn't set a terribly good example ourselves in some circumstances, the Americans in particular, with the horrific scenes that were captured on photographs, and, well, I'm sure be watched forevermore by people in the Middle East who feel that the United States doesn't value them as fellow human beings. So it's no surprise, perhaps, that abuse is going on in Iraqi jails. And, of course, this even predates the invasion of 2003 anyway, because it's not as if Iraq had a terribly good civil rights record prior to that. So I think the training of the new Iraqi army, prison officers and police appears to leave a lot to be desired. On a lighter note, though, it was quite heavy, I'll say that I think the hurling of the shoes at George Bush is probably one of my favourite George Bush moments. There were many comedy moments from the eight-year presidency of George Bush that we can now look back on and laugh at some aspects of it, and I think this man will go down in history as giving us a lighter moment towards the end of George Bush's presidency.
Well, apparently Muntada Al-Zaidi is the name of this journalist who threw the shoes, has seen in various countries little statues of shoes appearing as a kind of memorial to his act, a statue, a sort of carved shoe. The other thing is he's also had several offers from very wealthy Saudi princesses to marry him. So but anyway, he's also saying that he believes his life is still in danger, that he's had one death threat against him. But I think, you know, it just seems to me a pity that that now that the US is still there but the British troops have withdrawn, we've still got abuses going on inside Iraqi prisons. Both of you, either of you, do you think that there's an end in sight to this? Do you think that we can get to the stage where there is a sensible and civilised criminal justice system in Iraq?
I think the whole thing has been a tragedy. We blundered in there with no particular strategy for how we were going to deal with the peace. The war was, the hot part of the war anyway, was won fairly quickly, and Saddam was toppled, but it's fairly obvious that Blair and Bush had no strategy for how they were going to deal with the peace, and we've had years of carnage as a result of that, and I think it's going to take an awful long time for Iraq if it remains the entity of Iraq, for that matter, to recover from that. And there's lots of unfinished business. There's the intra-Arab conflict in between the Shia and Sunni Arabs. And, of course, there's the whole issue of what you do about the Kurds in the north, who have their own aspirations for freedom and a free state. And all of that is caught up with oil. As I'm sure some of you would say, and that was probably the motive for the war in the first place. But we can't get a resolution to having a free Kurdistan, probably, without some settlement over oil rights within Iraq itself.
So if we don't sort out the oil, Martin, can we have any kind of decent criminal justice system? I mean, is it just impossible?
One hopes that the political forces in Iraq, all of them, can come to some kind of accommodation. I think one of the problems is the Maliki government at the moment has got a great deal of hostility from the Sunni Awakening councils, who were insurgents against the Americans and then came over to the American side. And of course, what people have got to realise what that means is that the guys who were killing American soldiers then shake hands and say, let's be friends, pretty much like the IRA and the British Army here. Now, that is the way to peace, and it's the only way to peace, but it's very tricky because often hardliners, whether they're Sunni or Shia or American or British, don't want peace. I hope that the Iraqi people can find a way to settle their political differences. And I think we have to look at ourselves in this country and ask ourselves, what is our responsibility for creating this mess, and make sure that we do better in future.
Okay, on to our next story. And this is activists and anarchists who have been converging from all over Britain onto Bristol's empty pro-cathedral between the Clifton Triangle and Brandon Hill to discuss and act on a whole range of political and cultural issues. Over 60 workshops, screenings and other events are taking place over 10 days up to this coming Monday. Animal rights, anti-deportation, climate change, radical songwriting, yoga, the financial crisis and Britain's unpopular military adventures abroad, just to name a few. The full programme is the centre spread of a spoof edition of the Evening Post newspaper called The Evening Pest, which has been given away free from the pro-cathedral and sympathetic outlets around the city. But there have been street protests too. This morning, the co-mutineers, as they call themselves, have been in Bristol city centre repossessing the banks. And I understand that you were down there, Martin. Can you just tell us what was going on? How did they manage to repossess the banks?
Well, you were talking about symbolic protest, really. A group of people, many of them dressed in carnival costumes and masks. They processed around the various financial institutions in Bristol and made a bit of a nuisance of themselves as a protest against the banking crisis. I would encourage all young people to get involved in political activities, and I'm happy for the people to go out and get stuck in. But that doesn't mean that they're right about everything.
What about you, Stephen? Do you approve of this taking over of Bristol's empty pro-cathedral for this sort of purpose?
Well, they sound very organised for anarchists, don't they, I must say.
They pride themselves on that.
Yeah. No, I don't, is the honest answer. The pro-cathedral site is a very prominent site within the city that's needed redevelopment for a more suitable purpose for a long time. There is now a developer, I believe, who is going to convert the pro-cathedral into accommodation. You can argue about whether that's good or bad, but it's certainly better than a derelict building, which I think has been the case ever since I came to Bristol. I've lived here nearly 25 years now, and the pro-cathedral site has been an abandoned shell for all that period, and that is a dreadful shame. So I want to see that site redeveloped and not to be a blight on the landscape.
But you see, most developers are actually doing less work at the moment with the financial crisis. Absolutely, it's even less likely that that place is going to be used.
Can I just also say that they're not intending to stay there permanently, I understand. They've taken it over as an empty space, as a base for what they're doing this couple of weeks. They're not intending to stay there permanently.
So what do you disapprove of, Stephen? Because this is an empty space that wasn't being used. They've gone out and cleared it up, apparently, and they're doing all these workshops about climate change. And it would seem to me that what they're trying to do is look at solutions which aren't being offered to them by parties like yours.
well, I think my party has many solutions to the current credit crisis and many others as well, and we stand for election and put those to the democratic test, which of course anarchists obviously don't believe in. if they were stopping work going ahead on the building, that's what I would disapprove of, but maybe building work has stopped anyway. Certainly most building sites around the city, the cranes are at a standstill and have been for months. I also hope they respect the space that they're in, that is for hopefully going to be redeveloped for the benefit of Bristol, and don't damage anything while they're there.
I had a brief peep in there yesterday. It looked like there had been a tremendous amount of clearing up done. On the first day, I saw there was a couple of photos of the place when they first moved in there, and they'd managed to move actually out quite a lot of rubble and things like this, which were just lying around, and turned it into a usable conference venue.
Mm.
But you still don't approve, because I mean, I have to say, I when I was there yesterday, I thought this is just amazing that people can get this together in a derelict building site.
Well, I hope they're safe as well. We could have the parallel example, which has bedeviled me since right back to the days when I was a councillor in the 1990s, of Westmoreland House and the Carriage Works on Stokes Croft, which is another building crying out for sympathetic redevelopment. And occasionally that gets occupied by people, or people sort of trespass in there as well. And unfortunately, a few people have been killed by going up onto the roof and falling off. So when I say I disapprove, generally I think breaking into other people's buildings, and you may think you're cleaning it up, and you may be putting your lives and other people's lives in danger.
Right, well, anyway, let's have a little listen to one of the organisers of the event, and I asked him if he thinks our Democratic Party political system is failing us.
Hello, I'm Brendan McFarlane, and the group called Co-Mutiny have squatted a building, a massive cathedral, up in Clifton at the top of Park Street, left after the Waitrose. And they're holding, well, we are, because we are part of it, holding a week of different events that are going on around Bristol. And that's from discussion groups, workshops, skill shares, and then also going out into the streets and taking action and doing marches and protests against what we believe is wrong within our society, and trying to make people more aware of these issues. What we're doing here, as part of Co-Mutiny in the Emporium, is an exhibition of this space, as the Emporium is a previously disused, empty, derelict building, which is now turned into a gallery and a meeting place and a film place and a place where people can use it. Now, it links in on the issue of building, housing and the reuse of space. Co-Mutiny is a wide group of different groups that are arguing for different points across the board. So there are groups that are arguing about climate chaos, the fact that capitalism is at the root of climate change. There are people protesting about no borders, about borders in general, and calling for the freedom of movement for all people. I mean, we have a situation where people are woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning with immigration snatch squad police, and whole families are taken out of their homes, scared, attacked by riot cops, basically dragged into the back of vehicles, then put into detention centres and flown back to countries where they face the possibility of death threats, or an unstable existence, where in countries such as Afghanistan, Iraq, which we as the UK have invaded and are now warring upon their people. Other groups include groups such as Rising Tide, who are talking about climate chaos, and one of the main mottos or slogans that is coming out of the community is social change, not climate change. And that's the kind of thing that's unifying everybody together, is the fact that we're looking for social change and we're working towards it and creating our own ways of doing things apart from this system, where we have in Bristol, for instance, Cabot Circus, the consumer robot zone that we've just had imposed upon us. Why was that not a community market where people could go sell or trade their locally grown organic vegetables, their locally grown food from their own allotments, sell their artisanal products, exchange ideas, meet? Instead, what we did, what was imposed upon us, because I don't really think there was much consultation there, was from the Bristol Alliance, which is a company based outside of Bristol, and the profits go to a company based outside of Bristol. It doesn't go back into it. A company has put that in with shops that aren't part of Bristol, that are just corporate chain shops, so none of the money is actually going to within this city.
So, yes, that was one of the organisers, Brendan McFarlane, of the co-mutiny, the squat up in Clifton that there is, that's been staying there until the weekend. Stephen, is our Democratic Party political system failing us? Why do people feel that they have to go and organise these conferences like this?
I think the Democratic system is failing us, and Liberal Democrats, Liberals before us have been saying that for a long time. We have a ridiculous electoral system that simply isn't designed for a pluralist situation where you have more than two political parties. The current government is in office on 36% of the vote but has absolute power. We have a second chamber where people are still there because their great-great-grandfather 10 times over had an affair with a monarch. We have bishops in the House of Lords as well. We have strangulated local government. Yes, there is a crisis in our democracy, and we've got some solutions to it.
So what are the Liberal Party's solutions then? Those things you were talking about, electoral reform?
Well, first of all, there has to be electoral reform for all levels of government. I mean, the Welsh Assembly, Scottish Parliament and the European Parliament are now elected by different systems of proportional representation, but we need the House of Commons and English local government as well to be elected under a reform system. And this isn't Lib Dem special pleading. Now, I'm not sure I should dare mention the expenses crisis with MPs, but if you have a look at most of the people who did some pretty stupid and venal things with taxpayers' money, they tended to sit in safe seats. Now, we have life peers in the House of Lords, people who are in the House of Lords for life. We have life MPs as well, effectively under our first-past-the-post system. Where I grew up in South Wales, in the South Wales Valleys, if you're selected as a Labour candidate in your 20s, you will win the seat. You'll be there. As long as you keep the local Labour Party happy, you could be there for 40 or 50 years and know that you'll never be challenged. And that encourages an atmosphere where people will get away with ignoring the public's political opinions, but also doing things within the system that they should never have done as well. So reforming the electoral system isn't just about being fair to political parties. It's giving the voters maximum power over individual candidates, so every candidate knows that they have to justify themselves at every election.
So are you seriously saying that the anarchists who feel that the current system isn't representing them should join the Liberal Liberal Democrat Party?
Well, perhaps they should have a look. I mean, to be honest, I do occasionally get irritated by people who I meet saying, I believe in this, and this, and nobody represents me. And I say, well, have you actually looked on our website or read our manifesto, or do you read our leaflets? Because we believe in tackling climate change. We believe in cleaning up the political system. Maybe other parties out there do as well, particularly in Scotland and Wales, where there are other choices. And sometimes people are angry about the situation in general because of the stuff that they read in the media, but perhaps could explore what options there are. Fortunately, we don't live in a country where your only option now is to vote Labour or Tory. Those days are gone, and gone for good. And we do now have a pluralist political system. We just don't have an electoral system that enables that plural opinion amongst the electorate to be reflected in Parliament.
So what you're saying then maybe is that because we don't have the right electoral system, there is a justification for doing the sort of thing that's going on at this co-mutiny.
Oh yeah, I mean, obviously free protest is something a Liberal MP is always going to defend.
Martin, what's your thoughts, having had a chat to some of these people today? Do you think there was actually any point to the protest against the banks this morning?
Well, I think there is a point in protest, as Stephen has just said. I mean, protest is part of the democratic system. If you feel strongly about something, then do get off your bum and go and do something about it. I would encourage all young people to take that kind of attitude. But, of course, don't presume that you have all the answers, because the answers are going to take a while for us to work out through collective discussion. Don't be arrogant, in other words. You're not the only... I mean, for example, I, as it happens, I'm not working at the moment because I was made redundant. But lots of people who are working will say, well, I can't go out and protest at 11 o'clock on a Friday because I'm working. And now you don't want to be seen to be just so isolated from other people that you're talking to yourself. And that is a bit of a danger with the kind of thing that's going on at the Co Mutiny, potentially. But I think, on the other hand, it's important that issues are raised. And there was a bit of a scuffle at the beginning today, but there was no real damage or hurt to anybody. And people could see that, you know, these are young people who care about the future. And, that's fine. I've got no problem with that. But I think the electoral system is wrong, is broken. I think many Labour activists actually agree with that now. They ought to have agreed with it all along, because it's actually a matter of principle rather than a matter of tactics. I think the other thing that really undermines the political system is that no matter who you vote for, the bankers win. Obama came to power this time last year, or last November, in the US on a huge wave of desire for change. But much of the policy has remained the same, because it's set in concrete by the Federal Reserve, by Wall Street, by interests which are more powerful than the politicians. And when we're talking about the expenses scandal, everybody gets upset about that. All of the politicians' expenses added together don't add up to one banker's bonus. Yeah. And people have got to get a sense of perspective here. And the real problem is that the politicians actually don't have the power to tackle the problems. The real power in this country and elsewhere is elsewhere. And that's what alienates people, because it seems to me that whoever you vote for, you're going to get the same policy. And I saw this process in Poland when I lived there, where people voted for Solidarity, then they voted for the former communists, then they started voting for more extreme right parties, and whatever they voted for, the same neoliberal policy came out of the machine. And I think that's a fundamental problem that needs to be addressed.
Right, from one protest to another, both Bristol-based, this time a protest over Bristol's Conservative Party leader, Richard Eddy. Protesters calling for the resignation of Bristol's Tory leader were given a standing ovation at a city council meeting the other day. Around 30 people turned up to a full council meeting to express their anger at comments made by Councillor Richard Eddy about funding an anti-homophobia group. What are your thoughts on this one, Steve?
Well, EACH, which is Education Action Challenging Homophobia, is a charity I've supported for quite some time. They're based in Clifton, where they run a sort of helpline for young gay people who've been victims of bullying or their parents. But they're a national service, and they've got a national reputation. And I've hosted parliamentary receptions for them to highlight their work. So when I saw the front page of the Bristol Evening Post a few weeks ago, effectively endorsing what the Conservative leader in Bristol had said, and in an editorial giving him support, I was horrified. The Conservative Party in Bristol has got form on this every single year, going right back to when I was a councillor. They'll always attack something to do with the equalities agenda. Earlier this year, they were saying that the Legacy Commission, which is the fund that promotes community cohesion in Bristol after the commemoration of the bicentenary of the abolition of the slave trade 2 years ago, they wanted to cut that. In previous years, they wanted to cut the entire equalities programme of the council. So there's no surprise, really, for the Conservatives to attack lottery funding. Remember, it's lottery funding, not council funding, for a charity that essentially deals with homophobia. But I was rather annoyed by, I thought, the really slack journalism of the Evening Post in the way that they covered it, and didn't point out the simple financial facts of the case, where the award that EACH has got is for a 5-year programme of work, and it's not just in Bristol, it's in the four in the three neighbouring unitary authorities as well. So it's probably about £25,000 a year in Bristol, which is not much.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, what strikes me about this, I mean, obviously, I agree with a lot of what Stephen has said, is the National Lottery itself. It was the Conservatives who invented the National Lottery, I seem to remember. And one of the things they said about the National Lottery money when it was generated was that it couldn't be spent on mainstream services. They've had a National Lottery in Spain for many years called El Gordo, the fat one, but all of that money goes into mainstream spending. What I object to in the National Lottery is the creation of a whole bureaucracy to hand out National Lottery money, which wouldn't need to exist if all of that money had gone in, and it was a genuinely National Lottery, and the money had just gone into general government expenditure. Now, if you are going to subcontract it to a whole new bureaucracy to decide who's going to get the money, and don't forget it was the Conservatives who said that's how it should be, then you can hardly complain if that independent bureaucracy makes decisions. You can complain about the decisions, but you are the one who set this structure up. It was your idea to have the National Lottery. It was your idea to have it separate from local local government and national government, and now they're acting independently. Well, boo-hoo.
Stephen, do you think that Richard Eddy's comments will be a vote winner for the Conservatives in Bristol?
Well, we know there's always a certain section of society for whom prejudice is a motivator. Unfortunately, we don't yet live in a fully liberal society where people don't care about somebody's race or their religion or their social background or their sexuality in this particular case. And that's why the work of a charity like Each is so important. And what's been forgotten here, I mean, there was a lot of political hoo-ha on the internet and in the council chamber about this, and some of it, I think, was more political posturing. But what's forgotten is we are talking about child welfare. Bullying a child in school, whether physically or verbally, is enormously distressing to the individual and disrupts their education. And that's the remit of Each, to tackle that. And I think that's what has been forgotten at the heart of this story. It's about child welfare being used as a political football.
Coming up now then, it's the Sky News at 6, and that's all for this week. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review this week's news and discuss some of the significant stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guests, Stephen Williams, Liberal Democrat MP for Bristol West, and our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Next week, Simon Crew, Labour councillor for Brislington East, will be joining us. You can hear previous week's shows if you have broadband internet by going to bcfm.org.uk and clicking on Presenters on the right to find my Friday Drive Time page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land, so while it might seem there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because heartless banks and big business have taken away far more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out fairly and with modern technology, not control.